to the moon and back, and we will never stop looking for you.
Bergen County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald says he believes Jamie is out there and in danger. A funeral for her parents will take place Saturday. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In sports, the Bucks beat Philadelphia 123-108, improving to 4-0 for the first time since the 2001-02 season. A couple of free throws with less than a second left gave the Bulls their first victory of the season, a 112-110 win over Charlotte. Forecast from the National Weather Service, mostly cloudy today, a high around 52. Clouds tonight, a low of 37. Then for tomorrow, to end the work week, a slight chance of some showers during the afternoon and evening hours. Little change in temperature. Right now, clouds and 38. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Gregory Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it's always fun to welcome from his office across the hall, from our studios, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. We welcome you back to the program.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Right. And fall semester is in full swing at this point, isn't it?
Well, I certainly can tell. Sometimes the temperature is changing. Sometimes it's nice out again. But leaves are certainly changing. So, yes, fall semester. And in fact, I think we're just about through midterms now. So we're kind of getting ready for the end of the fall semester.
Hard to believe. Hard to believe. Well, before we get to our very special guest, I know there are couple of things that have kept you busy, including the happy matter of ribbon cutting and groundbreaking and so on, which is a nice sense of or indication of growth. Tell us about a couple of real recent events.
Yeah, we've been very proud and appreciative of our community's investment in Gateway, and we were so proud just a few days ago to have a ribbon cutting ceremony for our new, I call it our high performance engine program, but others will call it our marine mechanics and outboard power program. And it includes a great partnership with BRP, Evinrude, out of the Sturtevant area. And we've had a partnership with BRP for many years and have had some training programs over with them in partnership at the IMET Center. And about maybe a year ago, I read an article in a local magazine that indicated that there was a shortage of skilled technicians to work on outboard motors. And the only training program was located in Superior, Wisconsin. And that's
wow.
A long way to take a boat if you're in Kenosha or Racine or Walworth County. So we opened a partnership with BRP and asked if they'd be willing to help us put a curriculum together, a lab, and really try to drive some training opportunities for young people in high-performance engines in this area. And so when we cut the ribbon, of course, we had a great turnout, a lot of folks from BRP. I need to give a big shout-out, too, to Amanda Falvey, who was really our lead champion in helping us build this program. But the lab is located on the Racine campus. We have a big glass overhead door that looks right at Lake Michigan, so you get a feel for what it's like to be out on the water. And then it's stacked with things like Can-Am four-wheelers, side-by-sides, jet skis, outboard motors, and a really high performance type of environment. So we're excited to be offering those new courses in partnership with BRP and other great companies in our area. And then earlier this week, we had just a really fantastic groundbreaking for our new expansion to the SC Johnson Integrated Manufacturing and Engineering Technology Center, referred to as IMET. That project was about 14 months in the works, as it's a part of the Foxconn build-out for Southeast Wisconsin, and the funding for that project was included in the incentive funding that went toward the village of Mount Pleasant, and now Mount Pleasant has secured their own borrowing, so the money can be transferred back to Gateway, which gave us the go-ahead to start the construction project. And what that represents is about 36,000 new square feet of additional training space added to the original 60,000 that we already have at IMET. So we're going to be a little over 90,000 square feet of advanced manufacturing. And when I say advanced manufacturing, I mean our traditional CNC programs, which are critical to our workforce, but we're adding new programs in industrial data analytics, the industrial Internet of Things. We've talked about that before on the show, robotics, automation, cybersecurity. So an entirely new platform of manufacturing skills that we're going to be able to offer to young people and adults through that expansion. We had a terrific venue. Fisk Johnson, the CEO for SC Johnson & Sons, spoke and helped shape and frame the legacy responsibility that we all have in our community to help young people understand their pathway in life and if manufacturing is a strong pathway, that Gateway has the resources to make that happen. We followed that up with a great presentation from Alan Young, who is the director of U.S. Strategic Initiatives for Foxconn. He helped us look at the future, what Foxconn is bringing and what types of skills will be required to be able to work in a highly automated and integrated work environment. And then, of course, Governor Walker was with us as well, and Governor Walker announced then the $5 million grant to Gateway to expand the facilities. And I want to thank everyone for coming out. We had a couple hundred people that made it out to that event, and it was really a great celebration. And now the work really begins. We can start laying foundation and building new programs.
Great. Before we introduce our very special guest today, I know you also have some grant announcements that you're excited about.
Yeah, actually, it supports both of those programs. So Wisconsin has had a program called Fast Forward for, I guess, probably about 8 years already, and Gateway's always participated in the Fast Forward program. How that is, it's a set-aside funding that employers can apply for through the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, and typically in partnership with a local technical college, so in our case, Gateway, we would help write that grant and put some customized training together. So you might have 10 employees that need upgrading skills in blueprint reading or machine tool technology, and we would write a curriculum and make that happen. Because of the large need in Southeast Wisconsin to get ready for advanced manufacturing, Department of Workforce Development has offered or provided three fairly large grants to our region representing $2.8 million worth of resources for training for adults and for youth. And that's in partnership with the Racine County, with the City of Racine, with RAMAC in downtown Racine, with UMOS, and with Gateway Technical College. So Gateway will be the training provider for the majority of that, but all of those entities are involved in the recruitment and the onboarding and identifying the different skill paths. So we're going to really be expanding very quickly all of the entry-level fields of welding, CNC machining, advanced manufacturing programs, and we think that that's really going to be a great startup, if you will, to help reduce some of the skilled worker shortage needs that we have right here in Southeast Wisconsin.
Just think of all those partnerships. It's so exciting. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, explain to our listeners why you wanted to speak with Terry Iverson and why you wanted to be sure to speak with him during the month of October.
I am so proud to have Terry as our guest today. I've actually known Terry for over 15 years. When I first started at Gateway, he was one of the first folks that reached out to me to introduce himself and to talk a little bit about what technical colleges mean to our community and how his company could help support that vision for us. And we've stayed friends over all of those years. And as time has changed a little bit, Terry's taken on some really key responsibilities to help champion the cause, to help young people understand the value of manufacturing careers. And October being Manufacturing Month, we have a series of events that have taken place, including some of the announcements I just made. So I thought it would be appropriate for this month of October to invite Terry on the program to talk about, first of all, his passion for helping youth in careers. But then most recently, he is an author. He published a new book, Finding America's Greatest Champion. And I was very honored because I have an autographed copy in front of me because my name is mentioned in the book. So that's not why I have him here, but I am here because he took the time to interview several people around the country and gain a broader perspective on what we can all do to help foster our community's awareness of the importance of manufacturing. So
excellent. Well, Terry Iverson, we welcome you back to the morning show. It's been some time ago since you've been a guest. It's good to have you with us again.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and Brian today.
Why don't we start by having you give us kind of a capsule summary of who you are, where you come from, and kind of the road that's taken you ultimately to Iverson and Company and to the writing of your latest book, again titled Finding America's Greatest Champions.
Well, I'm a third generation owner and leader of Iverson and Company. My grandfather started our machine tool distribution company back in the 1930s. And my dad has been involved, and of course myself, this is my 38th year. I actually grew up in Florida after my parents unfortunately split up. I grew up in Florida, and then ultimately when I became an adult and eventually got married and started a family, moved to Wisconsin and ended up working for my dad as a Wisconsin salesperson. So education is important to me, and I talk a lot about that. And Wisconsin and Florida have notable roles in the book, as does Brian. Brian was one of the people I interviewed for the book, and he has some very valuable things to say in the portion that he's in.
Terry, you're always so kind. I've read it, and I think I've learned an awful lot from all of the other guests that you interviewed. And it's almost like when you're in the middle of a exciting time, you don't often recognize sort of the transformation that's taking place. And I can imagine, as you look back, having your grandfather starting the company in the 1930s, what life would have been like, and what the types of education and training programs would have been like, and the transition of your 38 years as a leader for the family organization, how to continue to stay focused on those really core values that an organization must abide by in order to stay in business for 78 years.
Yeah, no, the vision and of Champion Now, and I feel very strongly that my family and 93 years in manufacturing, that there's a time to pay it forward, and I've been a big mentoring individual adult for, oh gosh, probably 40 years of my life, and that's a big component in the book as well.
So tell us where this burning interest in education really comes from. What have been the most important factors that have sort of fired that within you?
Well, education has always been important to me. My father, stressed how important education is when I was a young person. And I went to down in the South where I grew up, I went to a very elite educational preparatory school, high school. And I actually learned more from that experience than, unfortunately, the five universities that I went to, and about excellence and overachieving and a lot of other things. But as far as of mentoring, and I was mentored as a young person, and so I've always felt compelled to mentor other young people as I got older. And so your educational choice and your educational path is a big part of that.
I'm intrigued with the idea of mentoring, because we have a lot of initiatives around our region and around the country on the importance and value of mentoring, and you combine that with an internship experience where you're gaining some real-world experience, almost like the, in the early 1900s, the apprenticeship model, which is very popular again right now in helping build that work-and-learn model, and that really is driven by sharing experiences. So whether it's a job-related experience or outside the job office, the mentoring is essential, because a lot of young people just don't have that sense of relationship at this point in their life, and building those relationships can really help provide that foundational support in many ways.
So explain to us about the organization Champion Now that you have founded. Explain when that organization was created and for what purpose. What is its mission?
Well, interestingly enough, Brian doesn't probably realize this, but Brian had asked me to serve on the CTE Education Foundation in D.C., and it was on a plane trip on my way to a meeting that Brian was at, actually, that I kept trying to figure out, how can I change perceptions? How can I change manufacturing perceptions? And as you might realize as I go through that, on a napkin, I started, inking down CHMP. And so I ultimately, Champion Now became an acronym that basically is changing how American manufacturing is perceived in our nation. And it just kind of fell together. And I didn't think much of it at the time, but many people kept telling me how awesome the acronym was and the positive message that it stood for, with the word champion in itself. And the now is the call to action. In fact, writing my book was one of the big components to drive action for people to do something. The vision and the mission of Champion Now is basically to change the perceptions of manufacturing careers, and really the book and the organization are kind of hand in hand. Finding America's Greatest Champion, of course, uses the word that's, you know, the acronym that I coined. So if I could help be a change agent in this country and the organization so that our culture is more accepting of those who make things and design things and use their minds and their hands, then there would be a lot more people not having to go down into debt and have this education that maybe is not serving them well when they get out, or not serving their passions that they're very passionate about.
Terry, I remember well our friendship in working on this National CTE Foundation Board. And, you know, I look at the term champion now, and I think of so many positive things that happen. It helps build self-confidence. It helps build, you know, a desire to achieve greater levels. And I think just the name itself can resonate very strongly with all sectors, not youth, adults, everyone that's really trying to find their place in the manufacturing setting or any type of job or career. And I love the fact that some of the best ideas always happen on a napkin. And I think that helps to spur sort of the creativity and the ingenuity that you bring to this effort. And leveraging the idea of a champion, whether it's through student competitions or whether it's through mentoring or whether it's through helping teachers do their very best in ensuring that students have the access to the knowledge, skills, and resources to achieve success. I think it's really a great foundation for many different aspects of education.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, this is Brian Albrecht's monthly visit to the morning show, and our guest today via telephone is Terry Iverson, a longtime friend of Brian Albrecht's, CEO of Iverson a Company, and author of a new book called Finding America's Greatest Champions. Is this your first book, Mr. Iverson?
This is my first book. I was on a plane to Taiwan, of all places, and when you're locked in an airplane for 13 hours, and you have all this information in your mind, I found myself typing for basically on a laptop for about 10 of those 13 hours, and that's how the book started.
Hmm. Explain to our listeners what is the impetus behind its title, Finding America's Greatest Champion.
Well, ultimately, when I first coined the title, it alluded to the main focus is that we don't realize in this country that manufacturing is America's greatest champion, and that was one of the initiatives that I wanted to accomplish. But as I then started designing what the book was going to be about, the subtitle is Building Prosperity Through Manufacturing, Mentoring, and the Awesome Responsibility of Parenting. So then came to another level of definition that the young person that you mentor is America's greatest champion, or the female gender that's very not represented adequately in the manufacturing sector can be America's greatest champion. So it could mean multiple definitions, but the initial mission and vision in writing the book and titling the book was basically that manufacturing should and can be, and in many ways is, America's greatest champion, but also young people too.
You know, Terry, and that's sort of the takeaway for me when I read the book as well, that there's a champion within all of us, right? And we can help others bring that out in a sense to reality by supporting, mentoring, it's, you know, parenting, all the things that you described. And a way to do that is to give people opportunity. And opportunity in manufacturing has always been sort of the core. It is the American dream, right? We like to make and build and fix things. And if we can really fully understand and comprehend what value that means, it's almost like what a friend of ours talks about, Nick Pinchuk, the dignity of work and how work can help elevate your own personal self-confidence and allow you to prosper and become champion at your own individual level.
Hmm. Mr. Iverson, explain to our listeners how this book is put together. When people pick it up and open it up, what do they find there? How have you put this book together?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, one thing I tried to do in the table of contents is basically highlight some of the 40 to 50 people I interviewed, because there's a lot of interviews from people from virtually all walks of life, not just manufacturing. And you can go to a part of the book that, you know, maybe you have a deep desire to learn more about than, you know, traveling through the book from page 1 to page 304. So I tried to divide it up into different segments. I tried to, you know, have a section on parenting, a section to educators, a section that tells a little bit of our family legacy, both in the beginning and in the end. There's topics of all different things, you know, items, but I think I also tried to invite different people that have very little to do with manufacturing, because to be honest, if I just wrote a book about manufacturing, the people that would need it the most are not the people that would read it. So I invited people from the media, friends of mine. I invited, you know, people from, you know, different industries, a couple authors that I knew that were not in manufacturing. One of the most notable personalities that I know that wrote the foreword for me is the former CEO, Greg Watson, of Walgreens. Mm-hmm. And he and I sat down on many occasions and talked about, is this book, Champion Now, is this something that the general public can find credence in and really interest in? Because he wasn't directly involved in manufacturing. And his answer on many occasions is, Terry, you have to do this.
Well, not only do you have to do it, I think we have to help find a way to share it so that educators and our entire sector that's engaged in helping young people have an opportunity to take some of the wisdoms that you have brought forward in your book so that they can leverage that and use that for their own benefit. I'm just, one chapter that really struck me is the one that you have where women in manufacturing changing the lens of what manufacturing is. And so it's that perspective that people bring to it. And when you hear from others that have been successful and in and out of manufacturing, you can draw a different focus on that lens. Maybe I could ask you to comment just a little bit on why that particular issue was so important, the women in manufacturing and changing that perspective.
Well, I've been a big advocate of women in the professional field. I've been a big advocate for women in my family, whether it be my daughter, my wife, my mom. And so it really spoke to me. And it just so happens that the Me Too movement started right as I was at the end of writing the book. So we even talk a little bit about that, about there's an opportunity for women in the, you know, all around the world, but notably in the U.S., to, you know, seize the moment and rise and elevate themselves into positions. I think I talk about Mary Barra from General Motors, how she's in a position that, you know, at one point not too long ago would be unheard of. Alison Grealis is notably quoted in the book. She's president and founder of Women in Manufacturing Association. And Jennifer McNally and I were very close, very good friends. And she at one time was president of the Manufacturing Institute, and so she was interviewed. And then there's many young people. Greg Watson and I talked a great deal about entrepreneurship, and so I tried to make a component in the book of that. And there's some young people that I've mentored, a young lady, Anisha Rao. She, at 17 years of age, I helped her get a patent pending with a friend of mine from Northwestern University in biomedical engineering.
Hmm.
And then lastly, there was a young lady that I coached in soccer. She entrepreneured, became an entrepreneur and developed a spray for women called pre-heels on the back of their heels so that they don't get blisters. And she's become very successful. So it's a very, you know, close topic and passionate topic of mine. And I just, you know, if I have met 15% at best of women in the manufacturing sector, that would be a very high number. The numbers that I've heard is somewhere in the 25 to 29%, although that seems very high for what I've experienced in my manufacturing career.
Well, someone, as you know, that has a daughter in engineering, manufacturing background, it's a very important conversation to have to make sure that we expose these careers at all different age levels and all different opportunities. So I appreciate that section for sure. And I've shared the book actually with Alyssa as well.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
You wrote this book to honor people who earn their living designing, engineering, tinkering, and dreaming of making things. Explain how you think maybe our country has kind of lost touch with this, because I assume that if we all knew that and all understood that, then there'd be no need to write a book like this. In what respect and what evidence can you cite that in fact our country as a whole seems not to have this appreciation that you think is so important?
Well, I think this country is all about the entrepreneurial element. I do believe in that. But I think we got away from it somewhere along the way. I remember hearing the term that we were going to be a service-based economy. And, you know, it really made me upset to hear that, being that my whole career was in manufacturing and my whole family's careers were in manufacturing. But I do think that we've, you know, there's been such a messaging in the media about everything going to China and everything going to, you know, India and other, you know, countries because of the cost of labor. And, you know, there's certain manufacturing that cannot leave our shores. We have a huge manufacturing industry in the medical field. We have a huge manufacturing in the defense field and, a lot of other facets. And, you know, the spirit of the American worker and being innovative is, you know, the best in the world. So I think that there is some manufacturing, you know, of lesser skilled traits in terms of, you know, items, you know, being manufactured that has gone overseas. But what that has done is the manufacturing that's here, in order to compete globally, has become very automated, very advanced. And so the skill set for that has gone, up to the point where, you know, we need workers and we need people that are extremely skilled, extremely talented, and extremely passionate. The other thing that I would go to say is that from the parenting standpoint, many of us, myself included, you know, have stressed the value of a 4-year or 5-year education at a university. And so now we have a student debt issue that's just out of control in this country, and people are spending tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars for an education that may not be, you know, relevant when they get out into the working world. So it's a very deep topic, but yes, I do think the appreciation in our culture throughout the country for people that make things, they're not elevated as high as they need to be, and we're stressing and importance on something that's not as relevant as it once was.
Let's talk for a moment about this skilled worker shortage that has come up quite a lot. To what extent is this book a response to that?
Very much so. I mean, a friend of mine, Nicole Martin, authored a book called The Talent Emergency, and she was one of the last people that inspired me to actually put pen to paper, so to speak. And she talks a lot about, you know, the emergency that we have in this country for the talent. And as we get more automated and as we get more advanced, the gap becomes wider. We have the people, both young and old, that are talented and blessed in so many facets that can help manufacturing. But this jaded view of manufacturing and the acceptance that people are perceived to having those careers doesn't always allow for people to, both young and old, follow their passion into those fields. So just to, you know, one component that I don't think Brian knows either is that I actually sent this book to all 50 governors in the country. In fact, I got a letter from Scott Walker the other day acknowledging that he had received it.
Excellent.
In the last chapter of the book, you make some recommendations to educators, parents, employers, students, mentors. Maybe you could tell our listeners about what some of those most important recommendations are and what prompts you to make those recommendations.
Well, I think one of the key opinions that I have is, in order to change the culture, it's going to take, you know, a little bit of change or dramatic, significant change from a lot of different segments. So educators, I speak to educators in that many times the educational model is not relevant, and we focus on maybe test scores, and we don't, you know, focus on problem solving and a lot of things that I think, or we don't allow young people to pursue areas that they, you know, that they truly are passionate about. As far as industry members, I'd speak to industry members that we need to get engaged. You know, industry members in manufacturing are quick to complain about the lack of skilled workforce, but rarely do they get involved in an altruistic way that betters not only themselves, but the community and the young people as well. Parents, you know, I talk to parents about, you know, maybe going down a four-year university or a four-year degree is good for one child, but maybe, you know, two other children in your family, it may not be. I speak to, you know, being your child's best friend is not always in the best interest of your child, that, you know, making them accountable and making sure that they're supported in a way that they become responsible, you know, members of the community. I speak to, you know, politicians a little bit, that we need to be a little bit more supportive of the manufacturing culture. And so by speaking to guidance counselors, a lot of times I speak to the guidance counselors that many times that, you know, they're so overburdened with so many responsibilities that maybe we need two different guidance counselors' definitions in schools today. So I speak to a lot of different elements, and those are just a few and why I think it's important, because in order to change the culture, we can't just focus on just one.
Terry, I think that's one of the most remarkable sections here, because there's a takeaway in here for everyone, and you can draw your own sort of a parallel to events that have happened in your life, but those are just solid recommendations and really emphasize values around being, you know, good, responsible people and helping others. I want to just ask one question here, because sometimes we see leadership in this area around television personality, and I can just relate back to Mike Rowe and Dirty Jobs and really trying to add value and dignity to work and expose some of the really important work that people do that doesn't often get recognized as being of value. And one chapter in here, you interview Jeremy Boat, who is leading the television show Edge Factor, which I'm actually pretty excited about. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about your interview with Jeremy and how you might see the parallels between what you're doing with Champion Now and what he's doing to help raise young people's vision of how these types of careers can be of value.
Well, first of all, to start with Mike Rowe, I think Mike Rowe is the epitome of what I'm talking about. I long for the day that maybe he and I can connect over my passion or our passion. But Jeremy, I met in 2011, maybe 2012, and we very quickly, I went up and introduced myself to him and basically told him that if he did not succeed, and he was just starting out then, that we as an industry had everything to blame for him not succeeding. So I became an early adopter of Jeremy in his quest to produce films, quickly recognized how talented he is and was. And so Jeremy and I spent a great deal of time together in the early stages, and there was a notable few people that were extremely influential in keeping him on the path to success. Oh, I think Sandvik and Modern Machine Shop, to name two, were very instrumental in him getting to where he is today. But Jeremy and I have shared a great deal of passion. You know, I was very, very thankful that he kept going at a time when he could have stopped. And I sponsored and helped one of his trailers that was basically called Metal and Flesh. And it was about, you know, an amputee that designed a prosthetic that was like no other prosthetic. And that was at a time that I felt Jeremy really needed support. But I think his vision and the quality of the films he produces is unbelievable.
Yeah, I was quite impressed when I heard him speak as well. And his the production that he has, very high-tech, very engaging for young people. And those are the types of things, whether it's the book that you've developed here, those video clips, that message, that story, really kind of rebuilds the idea of an American dream, right? An entrepreneur making things and really helping to solve some very important and critical issues and then being recognized for that.
Mm. So, what are your hopes for the future, and do you see any signs that we are making any progress in terms of changing attitudes that need to be changed?
Well, I go back to saying, you know, what I discussed a little earlier, in that, you know, we need to really have so many different people and so many different walks of life have a change in perception. That my hope is that I not only reach out into the community in the manufacturing sector, which, you know, is the easy part for me. The hard part is to have enough traction with the book to change perceptions outside of the manufacturing sector. And so my hopes are that it gets that, you know, the effectiveness of the book reaches well beyond the manufacturing sector and gets in the hands of parents, students, educators, because educators, obviously, you know, a lot of times they don't see manufacturing as a viable career path. And I'm certainly not talking about Brian and organizations like his, but, you know, four-year universities and other colleges that may not even have a manufacturing or engineering program. So that's my hope, is that, you know, I can effectively reach out and change perceptions across many boundaries, but certainly well beyond the manufacturing world.
Terry, I have to ask you this one as well, because you interview a mutual friend of ours, Mike Reeder, CEO over at Precision Plus, and Mike just last weekend held a Manufacturing Day open house to try to address a lot of the concerns that are identified in your book, helping parents have a conversation with their children, boys and girls, about the value of manufacturing, opening the doors of his company to show what types of high skills are available, and really engage a community dialogue. And he's done this on many occasions. But he is one of our champions here in Southeast Wisconsin and has helped Gateway advance the new RPM Center on the Elkhorn campus. And it's just those types of people, yourself included, Mike and others, that are really helping to raise the flag to ensure that we continue to provide great opportunities in education. So Mike shared with me that he was probably your best interview. So I just have to ask you, as the author, is that the truth?
Well, Mike Reeder is, without a doubt, one of the premier champions, not only in Wisconsin, but in the country. And as far as Manufacturing Day, you know, Jeremy Bowd and I had a meeting with probably 30 or 40 industry members in May of 2012, FMA included. And out of that meeting, Manufacturing Day was born. Basically, Jeremy and I had come out with an idea of manufacturing day of some sort, and Pat Lee from FMA said, wait a minute, we have this on the board's docket to approve. So that was when Manufacturing Day was an idea. Now it's become a reality, and now I think it's in its fifth or sixth year. And Mike Reeder is the epitome of what all of us in manufacturing should be doing, not only Manufacturing Day or Manufacturing Month, but to be honest, you know, every month throughout the year.
Absolutely. And you included, just raising the visibility. I think we had over 500 young people come through our campus on early October. And I mentioned earlier in the conversation today some of the special events that we've been hosting to try to promote manufacturing. And for us in Wisconsin, it doesn't have to be a day or even a month. It can be throughout the entire year. So collectively, your book is an inspiration, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. Thank you.
How can people find the book?
Well, there's two ways you can find the book. We have a website is one place, and it's called championnow.org. Championnow, there ends up being two N's in the middle, of course, .org. And there you can buy a pack of 12 books or a pack of 38 books. Each of those off the website will be autographed by myself. Then you can also buy it on Amazon. And right now we have the paperbacks in stock and the paperback version. And then we also have a hardcover version that'll be soon arriving, I think, this week. but it's not yet up on Amazon. But either Amazon or championnow.org.
The book, again, is titled Finding America's Greatest Champions, and the author, Terry Iverson. Terry Iverson, it was great to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you for making time for this.
And thank you for having me. I'm very appreciative.
And Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, we're always happy to have you on The Morning Show as well.
Thank you, Greg.
I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out our morning show today, I'm very honored to be connecting with a doctor with the renowned Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Helena Gazelka. She is an anesthesiologist for the Mayo Clinic, and her whole career has been about trying to relieve pain and delivering palliative care for a wide range of patients. She has also been chair of the Mayo Clinic's Opioid Stewardship Program, and she and a number of her colleagues at the Mayo Clinic share a very, very deep concern about this public health emergency in America, the prescription opioid epidemic. And so we're going to be talking with her about what the Mayo Clinic has discovered about the problem and some of its recommendations. Dr. Helena Gazelka, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. What a lovely introduction, and it's my privilege to be here today.
First of all, although a lot of us have certainly read a great deal about this opioid drug crisis, maybe you can help frame it in some terms that will make the gravity of the situation very, very clear. Just how extensive and severe a problem are we talking about?
Well, that's a great question, Greg. And what we were doing with the Mayo Clinic National Health Checkup is a little bit of a litmus test. We wanted to see what Americans understand and how they participate in healthcare regarding opioid use. And we know that opioid use disorder and overdose are a significant national concern at this point. I think most Americans are familiar with that. This is a problem that's growing, unfortunately. We're having more and more deaths every day and every year, and it's a growing concern. And so we want to empower individuals to have conversations with their doctors about proper pain management. And we recognize from the survey that a lot of those conversations just aren't happening right now.
So how are drugs being dispensed if they are not being dispensed without these conversations? I mean, are doctors simply prescribing and patients asking no questions? Is that the disconnect you're talking about?
Yeah, that might sound a little bit crazy, mightn't it, Greg? But I do think that that happens. I think that there is an assumption that when the provider hands me a prescription, this is the right thing for me to take. And what patients aren't aware of is that many times there are alternatives to opioids or adjuncts to them, so other medicines they can take that will reduce their need for opioids. And what we found out in our survey is that 94%, so it's almost every American who's given the choice, would choose to have their pain managed in another way than using opioids.
And do you think that is an outgrowth in part of this crisis that we're currently seeing? Or for a long time has this been a preference of people?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I would say that I do think that the growing knowledge about the risks of opioids and how much exposure there is in the news to this topic probably has contributed some to not only a very rational concern about using opioids, but also in some patients a fear of opioids. I've certainly seen that in some of my patients in the clinic.
Your biography lists you as chair of the Mayo Clinic's Opioid Stewardship Program. That is certainly an intriguing name, and I'm very curious to know what the Mayo Clinic's Opioid Stewardship Program is all about.
That is a great question, Greg, and I love to share about our program because we've done quite a bit of work since 2016. I chose the word stewardship because I think it's very important to recall that these aren't bad medications. They're actually very good and very appropriate medications in the right circumstances. And that when we use the term stewardship, it implies that we have a responsibility and that there's something positive about those medications, that they're valuable in some way. So we have worked hard on investigating how we prescribe at the Mayo Clinic, both here in Rochester and then throughout our enterprise, and compare that to what patients really use. So if patients have a surgery, for instance, do they really go home and use all of the opioid that we provided them with? And how do they dispose of it afterward, or do they? And what we found out is that we were significantly overprescribing for many of our surgical procedures. Over 60% of the opioids prescribed were going unused. And we have formed some guidelines here at Mayo to help prescribe more optimally. They're individualized both for the patient and for the procedure. And I think that's a really important point. But also we've been involved in educating our employees, our providers, our patients, and in implementing change, even on a national level. We've been involved nationally in the conversations that are going on regarding opioid legislation, and that's been really important to work, I think.
I'm curious what the connection is between your specific specialty as an anesthesiologist and the opioid medication crisis. I mean, does some of this actually fall under the umbrella of what an anesthesiologist is responsible for? I think most of us don't think of that term with that in mind. We think of the anesthesiologist as that person that puts us under in the operating room. Explain what the connection is.
Yeah, that's really true, Greg. I think that a lot of people perceive that. I'm specialized in pain medicine, so after I did an anesthesiology residency here at Mayo, I completed a pain fellowship in interventional and medically managed pain, and also a palliative medicine fellowship. Most pain specialists in the United States are anesthesiologists, probably over 80% of them started with an anesthesia residency. And there's a recent study from the CDC showing that while primary care providers are the largest prescribers of opioids in the United States, pain physicians are one of the highest prescribers because we see so many patients with chronic pain and help manage them medically.
Are there other kinds of pain medications that are not opioids that exist now or are being developed? And is that a significant reason for hope for a better future?
I think it is a really good reason for hope. Even now, we have many, many medicines that can be used to manage pain and are not opioids. They fall into various classes of medications that we are using to treat pain, and many of them are more successful than opioids, actually. And I think that's one of the benefits of seeing a pain provider for chronic pain, is that they can help identify those solutions. Even in the opioid realm, there is some really interesting work going on. There's work to identify who's at risk for addiction if they take a pain medicine. Are there some people who really are at much higher risk than others? We believe that to be true, but we don't know the genetic basis behind it at this point. Also, many of the opioid medications are being made either tamper-resistant or we're looking at alternatives to opioids that act similarly to them, but they do not have perhaps the same risk of addiction as opioids do.
Finally, I want to give you a chance to talk about the event coming up on October 27th, National Prescription Drug Take Back Day. Explain what this event is about.
Oh, sure. This is an event hosted by the DEA, and it's available in many communities. One of the things that we found out in our survey is that Americans don't know how to dispose of their opioids. And from earlier research, we also know that they really don't know they should. And it's important to keep those medicines out of medicine cabinets where they may be available for misuse or diversion. And so the DEA Drug Take Back Day offers sites for people to bring back their medications, anything that's unused. It doesn't have to be an opioid. No questions asked. They just turn it in and surrender it, and those medications are destroyed commonly the same day or the next day. We are hosting one here at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and this is an event that's held twice yearly. We had one in April, and now, as you mentioned, on October 27th again.
Very good. More information is available about all that the Mayo Clinic does on this and other concerns at their website, which is mayoclinic.org. Dr. Helena Gazelka is an anesthesiologist for the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Dr. Gazelka, thank you for making time for this interview. Best wishes to you and your colleagues at Mayo.